We often fail to appreciate the institutions that keep our society functioning smoothly. For example, we do not often think about the many services provided by our city and state governments. The streets and roads and bridges that we use all the time. The fire and police protection that we take for granted. The schools and hospitals and parks and so on. The only time when we give them much thought is when these services aren't there when we need them. Then there will be plenty of complaining and blaming. We are even less likely to think much about the many services provided not just to us, but to people throughout the world community, by the United Nations, and the many worldwide organizations and programs connected with it. We can't appreciate and support the United Nations unless we know at least something about its history and structure. The UN was developed before World War II ended. The charter was worked out in May and June of 1945 in San Francisco, before the first atomic bomb was exploded, and some months before the end of World War II. The UN Charter received enough ratifications to go into effect on October 24th, 1945, and that's the reason that that day, October 24th, is celebrated as UN Day. We need to keep in mind the distinction between the United Nations organization proper, located in New York, on the one hand, and the UN system, made up of many international specialized organizations with headquarters all over the world, on the other hand. The UN proper in New York consists of six organs or parts. All but the International Court of Justice are located in the UN building in New York City. The UN is a voluntary association of national governments. That's critical to keep in mind. The UN is a voluntary association of national governments dedicated to dealing with global problems. It is not a government. It cannot make laws. It has no way of enforcing its resolutions, even the theoretically binding resolutions of the Security Council. What are called UN peacekeeping forces are actually only contingents of national military forces which are loaned by national governments to the UN for pay for a limited period of time. In fact, governments like Fiji, why are there peacekeepers from Fiji? Because the UN pays the government of Fiji less than pays the government of Fiji more than the government of Fiji pays their own soldiers. So it's a money-making proposition. And that's the case for many national governments who have their peacekeepers working for the UN. The UN's only source of financial resources is the voluntary contributions of the member nations. And the tiny budget of the United Nations is under $2 billion a year, which is less than the budget of any state government in the United States. The main organ of the UN is the General Assembly, where each of the 192 member countries has one vote, regardless of its population, regardless of its geographical size, regardless of its economic power. One vote per country. The General Assembly controls the UN itself, including the budget. But on international issues, it can only adopt non-binding resolutions suggesting one or another action. One of the more important things done by the General Assembly has been the sponsoring of international conferences on matters such as control of population growth, the rights of women, the rights of children, and disarmament. These conferences have marked the start of new international treaties concerning the oceans, concerning control of nuclear weapons, concerning protection of the environment, and getting started the creation of the International Criminal Court. Under the Reagan administration in the 1980s, the United States adopted a policy of refusing to help pay for these international conferences because they were advancing liberal causes opposed to the views of the religious right. The current battle against U.S. ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty, having to do with the oceans, is led by these same ultra-conservative groups. Even though ratification is supported by businesses, the military, and much of the Republican Party, this is a big battle that's going to be going on in the Senate over the next couple of months. Will the United States ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty? There's only a very small group that's opposed to it, but they are very powerful. Theoretically, the most powerful part of the UN is the Security Council, which has representatives from the five permanent members, Britain, China, France, Russia, and the United States, the big powers of World War II, each of which can veto any resolution. That means they can stop it from being passed even if everybody else is in favor of it. And then there are 10 representatives from other countries elected by the General Assembly for two-year terms. Approval of a resolution in the Security Council requires 9 affirmative votes and the absence of any veto from the permanent members. In principle, all member nations must obey resolutions adopted by the Security Council, but that doesn't always happen, and in fact, the U.S. invasion of Iraq was an example of acting contrary to the Security Council. The third body, the UN Economic and Social Council, ECOSOC, consists of representatives from 54 countries, and they are elected by the General Assembly, and it oversees the work of the UN system that I'm going to be discussing later. The fourth body is the Trusteeship Council, but it is no longer needed because all the colonial territories previously held in trust have now become independent countries. So it's sitting there with no job. But it's possible that the UN is going to give this Trusteeship Council a new responsibility of protecting the environment. It is called the Trusteeship Council, and it could be given that kind of task. The Secretariat, the fifth organ, consists of all the employees of the United Nations itself. They are the managers, secretaries, translators, interpreters, janitors, and so on, and are under the control of the Secretary General. The ambassadors and representatives of the national governments are not UN employees, but are employed by and paid by their national governments. So there's this very important distinction between the people who work at the UN, who are employed by the UN, and those people who are the representatives and ambassadors of the national governments, who are working for their national governments. The sixth organ is the International Court of Justice, or World Court, which is located in The Hague in the Netherlands. And it consists of 15 justices, no two of whom can be from the same country. They are elected for 9-year terms by a majority vote in both the General Assembly and the Security Council. They have to get a majority vote in the General Assembly, majority vote in the Security Council. This International Court of Justice, or World Court, adjudicates legal disputes between national governments. It's a matter of international law. What does this treaty say? How do we apply it to this particular case? It is to be distinguished from the recently established International Criminal Court, or ICC, which has the authority to try individuals for war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. This is a rather new court that's been established in the last few years to be able to prosecute individuals. The UN system consists of 19 specialized agencies, including the International Atomic Energy Agency, which reports directly to the General Assembly rather than the Economic and Social Council like the others, plus 13 subsidiary UN organizations or programs, so there's 32 altogether. Several of these organizations, such as the International Labor Union and the Universal Postal Union, existed before the UN was created. Many of them were at the same time that the League of Nations was functioning. If there were a world government, these various agencies and organizations would be the departments of that government. Now, rather than naming all of these specialized agencies, let me just mention a few of the better known ones, along with where their central office is located. There's UNESCO, the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, which is in Paris, France. There's the World Health Organization, which is in Geneva, Switzerland, WHO. There's the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, in Montreal, which, among other things, has said that on all international flights, they have to use English. They can use other things, too, but on any international flight, the announcements, everything has to be available in English as a result of a decision of ICAO. The International Telecommunications Union, which is in Geneva, Switzerland. The Universal Postal Union is in Bern, Switzerland. The International Monetary Fund, which is in the news right today, the IMF, is located in Washington, D.C., but it's not part of the World Bank Group. But the World Bank Group, which is also in Washington, D.C., has five subsidiary organizations: the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, International Development Association, the International Finance Corporation, the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, which means that if something happens to the private investments overseas, there's an agency that can guarantee, can offer insurance to private businesses, International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes. So these things may not be very important to us, but they're certainly very important to people in other countries where there are investments by U.S. and European corporations. Then there's the World Intellectual Property Organization, which protects copyrights and so on. The 13 subsidiary UN programs include things like the World Food Program, the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, that we're going to be collecting money for next week, the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees. If you're not a refugee, you don't care much, but if you are a refugee, this is very helpful that there is a UN Office of High Commissioner for Refugees. There's the UN Development Program, the UN Environmental Program, the UN Fund for Population Activities. And that's just some of the programs. Can you imagine how many people in our world community, especially those in poor countries and those engaged in international business and travel, depend greatly on these agencies and programs? They are critical, even if not many U.S. citizens are involved in using them. Now, why was the UN created, and what has it done? The UN was created under the auspices mainly of the United States as a way of replacing the League of Nations, which according to U.S. leaders in 1945 had failed to prevent World War II in the 1930s, mainly because the United States had not joined the League of Nations. The United States did not ratify the Versailles Treaty, and the covenant of the League of Nations was in that treaty. People may not realize a majority of the Senate voted in favor of it, but it didn't get the two-thirds vote. So as a result of that, the United States did not join the League of Nations. The original 51 countries that were in the United Nations were mainly the Western countries, including Latin America. 17 of the 51 original members of the UN are from Latin America. And the Soviet countries, who after all fought together with us in World War II to defeat Nazi Germany and militaristic Japan. The basic idea of the UN was that the countries which had together won the peace in World War II would continue to work together to preserve it afterward. Both the League of Nations and the United Nations, both American ideas, were efforts to make the international system more democratic, rather than being controlled by a few powerful countries. But the recent shift now toward more influence for the G8, the eight top economies, reflects a move back to the old system where the big and powerful countries control things. There's kind of a tension between the G8 and the United Nations. During the first 10 years of its existence, the UN did virtually whatever the US wanted it to do, despite a steady stream of vetoes in the Security Council by the Soviet Union. For example, the resolution on the partition of Palestine to recognize the State of Israel was adopted by the UN General Assembly in November of 1947. The Convention Against Genocide was adopted on December 9, 1948, and the next day, December 10, 1948, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, formulated basically by Eleanor Roosevelt, was approved 48-0, with three abstentions, all of them from the Soviet bloc. December 10th is still celebrated annually as Human Rights Day. A prime example of the influence of the U.S. was the Security Council action against the communists in Korea in 1950. This effort, led by the United States, was an attempt to show that collective security could stop aggression. Action was possible only because the Soviet Union was boycotting the Security Council at the time to protect the fact that the Chinese communists, who had taken over the mainland of China in 1949, were not allowed to appoint China's UN representatives. And as a result of that, the US was able to get the Security Council to declare North Korea an aggressor. After 1955, 10 years later, many former colonies in Africa and Asia became independent countries. And this is one of the great successes of the UN, is that it monitored this process so that these countries did not have to fight wars of independence. How could they make sure that they were a new country, an independent country, when they were accepted into the UN? That was how they got recognized by the rest of the world community as independent countries. And they became UN members as part of that process. The United Nations went from 51 members in 1945 to 100 in 1960 to 192 now. Many of these new members being former colonies or even mini states, some with populations of less than a million people. Islands out in the Pacific that you may never have heard of, like Tuvalu, they're members of the United Nations. But they are independent countries. During the Cold War, which ended in 1989, the General Assembly, generally controlled by the poorer countries, now that there are so many of them, became even more influential at the UN because the Security Council was immobilized by the threat of opposing vetoes by the Soviet Union or the United States. It was during this period that the General Assembly called all these international conferences on global problems. Early U.S. dominance of the United Nations ended temporarily in October of 1971, 22 years later, with a vote which permitted the Communist government of China, rather than Taiwan, to appoint China's delegates to the UN. Can you imagine how influential the United States was in the UN that for 22 years, the Communist Chinese did not get an opportunity to appoint the Chinese representatives at the UN? But U.S. dominance at the UN was regained after the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, because that meant no more Soviet veto. The low point of U.S. influence in the UN was the adoption of the Zionism is Racism resolution in 1975. This alienated not only the government of the United States, but the Jewish American community in the United States that had been one of the biggest supporters of the UN. That resolution was officially repealed by the General Assembly in 1991. But what is perceived as an excessive U.S. support for Israel is one basis of anti-U.S. sentiment in the UN. One of the biggest conflicts going on in the UN right now has to do with U.S. support for Israel. In fact, that's been the basis of almost all the vetoes that we have cast in the UN. When the Cold War ended in 1989, many people, including the first President Bush, thought that we would see a new world order. And in fact, he used that expression. You should remember that the first President Bush had been a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. So he was very well acquainted with the UN. He saw, and others saw, that the UN would be now working as originally intended, under U.S. leadership, because there would be no more vetoes by the Russians. In 1991, the UN Security Council approved military action against Iraq for invading Kuwait. So this is the second time that we have the UN stopping aggression. The US-led coalition defeated Iraqi military forces, and the UN adopted sanctions against Iraq to be enforced by the UN. In other words, in this first Gulf War, this was fought under the authorization of the United Nations, and it stopped, and the results were turned over to the UN to take care of the aftermath of the war. The 1991 Gulf War against Iraq was regarded as a new model for collective action to deal with the problem of aggression through the United Nations. During the years 1988 to 1995, UN peacekeeping operations were greatly expanded, with many new operations in Namibia, Cambodia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Angola, Guatemala, El Salvador, Haiti, Mozambique, Western Sahara, Uganda, Rwanda, Liberia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Kosovo, Georgia, and Somalia. Altogether, between 1948 and 2007, the UN has established 60 peacekeeping missions, 44 of which have been completed, while 18 of them are still at work. There are also 10 political and peace-building missions going on in Africa, Asia, and Middle East. our media does not pay much attention to what's going on here with regard to efforts to keep tensions from degenerating into wars. But the UN is active in many places all over the world. War crimes tribunals to prosecute individuals guilty of war crimes were established by the UN Security Council for the former Yugoslavia in May of 1993 and for Rwanda in November 1994. So those, and they're still functioning, those war crimes tribunals. In January 1997, Kofi Annan of Ghana became the seventh UN Secretary General. In 2002, he was re-elected for another five-year term. And just last January, Ban Ki-moon of South Korea became the new Secretary General of the UN. In 1998, the Rome Statute establishing the International Criminal Court, the ICC, which can prosecute individual tyrants and terrorists for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity was adopted. Its jurisdiction began on the 1st of July 2002, and 105 countries, that's more than half of the countries of the world, have become supporters, but not the United States. President Clinton signed the treaty on the last day when it was possible, December 31st, 2000, and then the United States has not ratified it. And in fact, one of the first things he did when he took office was the new president, the second President Bush, renounced the signing that Clinton had done, said, "We unsigned the treaty." Well, you can't do that. Can't unsign international treaties. The UN doesn't regard us as having unsigned it, despite what the US Congress has done. And in 2001, after the terrorist attack on the Twin Trade Towers and the Pentagon, the UN Security Council authorized military action against Afghanistan for providing support to the terrorists. And that UN-authorized action against terrorism in Afghanistan still continues. It's been overshadowed by what's going on in Iraq, but the process in Afghanistan was a different process authorized by the UN. In 2003, the US failed to get UN Security Council support for taking military action against Iraq. It nevertheless launched an attack on Iraq with help from Britain and some other allies. Now the United States needs assistance from the UN and other countries in pacifying and rebuilding Iraq, but it is still reluctant to turn over primary responsibility for nation building there to the UN. And not only that, members of the UN have the attitude, you got yourself into this, we're not going to bail you out. The UN is considering how to stop the genocide now going on in the Darfur region of Sudan. That's what this meeting next Tuesday is going to be about. The UN Security Council has approved a joint peacekeeping effort with African Union forces working alongside the UN peacekeeping forces. The International Criminal Court has indicted a top Sudanese official for crimes against humanity, and also another leader of the Janjaweed, but the government of Sudan is still resisting any outside intervention, won't let the UN officials get inside the borders of Sudan. The UN is still working on how it can implement the newly adopted Responsibility to Protect principle, which says that national governments have an obligation to protect the rights of their own citizens, and that the international community can intervene if they don't. The problem is figuring out how to implement that. Other issues confronting the UN are how to stop the spread of nuclear weapons, how to control terrorism, and how to get richer countries to follow through on their pledges of more financial assistance to the poorer countries. The gap between rich and poor is still growing. And it's an incredible thing. If you look at the statistics, you'll see that the money coming out of the poor countries is greater than the amount of money going into the poor countries. Another big issue is getting sufficient funding for the UN itself. The UN is always on the brink of bankruptcy. Its only source of funds is assessed contributions paid by the national governments. But non-payment by many countries, including the U.S., means that the total debt owed to the UN by all the countries is now about $400 million. The UN cannot borrow money, so it regularly faces financial crisis. Only 40 countries out of the 192 countries regularly pay the money that they owe the UN. And the U.S. is one of the leaders keeping the UN rather powerless by keeping it poor. This is part of our strategy. With regard to the future of the UN, the UN needs to make some fundamental changes in the years ahead. One that the U.S. is particularly interested in is a better civil service. Needs to be created to get more professionalism in the staff instead of having so many people appointed from less developed countries just because their governments want them to serve there, even though they're not competent. Some governments argue that the Security Council should be enlarged to include Japan, India, Brazil, and Germany, and that use of the veto by the Permanent Five has got to be limited in some way, or possibly even eliminated. The UN will need to acquire its own individually recruited police force, hired and paid by the UN itself, instead of always relying on borrowed national military forces, as is done now. The UN will need to acquire its own independent sources of income so that it is not so dependent on national governments, many of which are not paying what they owe. Before the UN will be allowed to acquire its own independent sources of income or much independent power, there will have to be changes in the voting arrangements so that the less developed countries do not so completely control the General Assembly, and also so that the veto power in the Security Council, still allowed to the five leading Allied countries during World War II in 1945, is either totally eliminated or drastically limited. Such changes are now resisted by the United States, except that we want Japan on the Security Council. But eventually, our leaders will see that changes are necessary to create a new international system where war and terrorism are replaced by institutions using democratic, political, and judicial procedures to resolve conflicts. Conflicts of interest which occur within nations and between nations will need to be settled by peaceful elections and the rule of law rather than by war, violence, and military action. At present, the biggest challenge to the UN and global democracy is a lack of support, financial and otherwise, by a unilateralist U.S. administration, which may finally be modifying its views. I'm hopeful on this because of the problems it faces in Iraq. It does seem like maybe a little bit we're giving a little leeway. We're even in Darfur, we're even helping the International Criminal Court a little bit. So maybe the government of the United States is gradually recognizing that it needs to work with the UN instead of against it. If you want to keep informed about the UN, I urge you to join the UN office. Their newsletter will help you to be posted on the latest things going on at the UN.